Thursday, June 20th. How hard it is to come by a day of one's very own. I've been here a whole week. The time devoured by filming, by the whirlwind of activity and people that Lyndon's presence always brings, by going over these houses with Bess and making notes about we need a new bedspread in the trailer and a light to do makeup by on the dresser in the Cedar House. And at last, this morning, I shut the door and cut off the phone and spent the whole morning taping, emerging about 12:30 to continue my rounds with Bess, have lunch, check on Simone and the filming operation. It's all finished. And at 2 o'clock, Operation Park. Because Jerry Rogers, the National Park Service historian, who is doing a sort of background script to provide material from which the Park Service will suggest exhibits for the visitor center in the park across the river, is here, I thought it would be good to have another one of the meetings of all the diverse people that are working on that park and expose him to it. So just yesterday, I'd had them called. And at 2 o'clock, we began converging in the Big Rock living room. Mark Gosden, head of Texas Parks and Wildlife. Roy Rodman, head of the landscape artists of the Texas Highway Department. Curtis Tunnell, the archaeologist, who'd been doing research on the log cabins. And Nancy Cott, the total exhibit staff of Texas Parks. Tyrus Cox, the president of the Gillespie County Historical Association. The ever-faithful Roy White. And amazingly and delightful, John Ben Shepherd, whom I had called at 11 o'clock last night on the way out chance that he just might possibly could come, or at least ought to be, out of courtesy, notified that we were meeting. He flew in, probably the busiest one of us all. And Jerry Rogers from the National Park Service. We spent about 3 hours, everybody reporting on the progress in his own field. Mark Gosden, whom I grow to like more and more, had the most hard news to report, of course. The bids had come in and gloriously under the estimate, and the contract had been let. I think maybe there was one more hurdle of red tape, but it's virtually firm. Through Mr. Tyrus Cox, stone from an old pioneer house over 100 years old that was being demolished, had been obtained as a gift for the visitor center. The fence around the wildlife area was proceeding, with one, thank heavens, change. Some steel stays would be removed and cedar ones inserted. Curtis Tunnell reported on the stone foundations that had been uncovered right in front of the visitor center. No, they don't know what it was. Dwelling house or barn? It was tentatively decided just to leave them there, probably grass right up to the edges. As a sort of exhibit, Nancy Cott will soon have her furniture outlays ready for all of the cabins. And Mr. Cox insists that once the word gets around, once there are several stories in the paper about these old log cabins and the need for furnishings, that local people will come forward with the items. That sounds optimistic to me, but he is quite assured. And of course, there was one thing that I kept on harping over and over. This was the best spring within my memory. Within the next 2 weeks, we had an opportunity unparalleled to harvest wildflower seed. If we could combine all efforts to do this, and it's a now or never proposition, and scatter truckload after truckload, particularly close to the roads in the little park, it could mean a lot for years to come. And here, of course, is where Mr. Rodman came in. All eyes turned toward him. It's well known that the highway department has the know-how, 30 years of experience. What could they do? He explained how the highway department had already scattered seed along Ranch Road 1 and on the road from Stonewall to Albert. And he very gallantly promised cooperation, but I cannot say that he firmly assured us that X numbers of truckloads would be put into the park itself. I reported that Dale had already harvested and spread some 2 truckloads inside the park alongside the road that enters from 290 and told them about the conversation I had had with Bill Crook about the Job Corps boys at Camp Gary, who are taking landscaping as one of their courses, would be available to harvest and spread a sizable amount within the park. Mark Gosden was ahead of me every foot of the way. He's already laying out a program for them, which includes also cutting deadwood out of some of the trees and other landscaping work. I was delighted, and I told them that our ranch could furnish quantities of Gallardia and Coreopsis seed, daisies and thistles, a great mixture, and Dale could show them where to harvest. Every now and then, John Ben Shepherd would come forward with a sage or funny observation, often jogging us off dead center and nudging us along the road toward conclusions instead of conversation. He told of the grant of $35,000 by Lawrence Rockefeller, $5,000 of it for an overall plan to be done by the National Park Service, and the remainder toward the implementation of the plan, the whole thing to be matched by other contributions. But it's vague in my mind whether they are state or individual contributions, and whether this $35,000 grant is really in our hands to use if there are no matching funds raised. All sorts of talents have gone into this little park, from botanist to archaeologist to canny fundraiser to loving restorer of old log cabins. And what is my role? I just furnish a setting and call us all together, compliments on the things we've already done, and hopes for the things that still remain to do, and cold beer and hot mochi specials. And someday there'll be something we can all be proud of, I believe. We wound up on the note of whether we should begin to have publicity, stories about what we were doing, and if so, how. Art Covert wants to do a full page, Mark Gosden tells me. We all agreed that very soon we should get going on this. Heaven knows we've suffered enough from the blasts of unfavorable publicity, so we might as well try to tell our story in pictures and exhibits. Everybody left about 5:30, and I set off alone, in that mood that always comes at the end of one of these trips to the ranch, wanting to stick out your hand and make time stand still, and savor the end of day as I ride over the top of the Martin and look out on the 360-degree view of rolling hills and big white clouds and little church steeple in the valley. The purple thistles are just reaching the end. The coreopsis, which had been a carpet of gold over pasture and hillsides 2 weeks ago, are now almost gone. But the gallardia are still blooming profusely, especially in the dance, and there are stretches that are just a meal fleur of every color. Pink Texas star and purple wine cup. Millions of little white daisies and Mexican hats in every combination of pale gold, golden brown, deep almost orange, and even brown velvet, and some of the white Mexican poppies that look so exotic, and a good many other flowers that I never saw before and cannot even name. The tower called me that Les and Liz had arrived. Everybody was ready, Bess and the children and Simone, and so I went back to the ranch, boarded the conveyor, full of film crew, stewards, and our little group, and off we put for Andrews, with a very amusing recital en route from Liz and Les about their adventures at Hemisphere. They have a talent for quickly discovering the brightest and most fun people. We had sandwiches and drinks, tried to take a nap, arrived at Andrews, rode in hearing a brief capsule of what the last 2 days had been like in this capital. The headlines had said 50,000 march in support of the poor, but it had gone off reasonably peacefully, Mrs. King emerging as the most dramatic person, and my heart went out, as it has all this summer long, to Walter Washington and to Nash Castro. And by 1 o'clock, I was home in the White House and to bed.